All right. So the second tumor panel of the day, B-cell malignancies, we're going to talk about the recent advances, remaining challenges, and promising new approaches, mostly focusing on CLL as a model, but we're also going to be talking about other applications in broader B-cell malignancies. But since it is such a diverse space, and we have limited time to talk about it, we thought we'd focus mostly on that. But so, B-cell malignancies, so they're a very heterogeneous group of lymphoproliferative disorders. Based on the WHO, 2008 WHO criteria, there are about 25 different subtypes of B-cell malignancies out of the whole, lymphoma subtypes, which are about, 54 or so, I believe. The estimated new cases and deaths in the U.S. in 2014 are estimated to be about 70,800 new cases causing about 19,000 deaths. There's a much broader prevalent patient population, particularly in the more indolent and chronic leukemias and lymphomas. So just to focus the discussion for today, so B-cell malignancies, they're very diverse in their natural history and disease course and their response to therapies. What we're mostly going to focus on is up here in the upper right corner, follicular lymphoma and CLL, mostly talking about CLL today, but also other applications, and may even talk about other B-cell malignancies like ALL, which isn't on this chart, but probably mostly briefly. So rituximab and CD20 targeted antibodies have really made a significant impact into the outcomes of B-cell lymphomas. However, many of the novel agents that have been recently approved in the last several years or are soon to make impact, I'm not going to really touch on it because the panelists will be describing these in detail in the upcoming minutes. But what I wanted to point out, though, is that, we've had this recent inflection in the value of the B-cell malignancies market. So if we added up all the potential B-cell malignancies where many of these broadly applicable agents, either B-cell receptor pathway inhibitors or antibodies or the immunotherapies that we had just talked about earlier today, it could grow to be one of the largest pharmaceutical oncology markets, on par with solid tumors like breast cancer. However, it is a very fragmented market with many, many different subtypes of B-cell malignancies. And we look at what's driving, it's really a few drug classes that are really driving the recent growth. BTK inhibitors, PI3 kinase inhibitors, some of the antibodies, and even the immunotherapies are starting to get forecasted as stimulating some growth in the market. And if we just take the case of Imbruvica. It's on its way to becoming the fastest growing cancer drug in terms of U.S. sales. It had a very rapid launch over the first year, the first four quarters after launch. So it is a disease area that is in need of new therapies, and patients are seeking these novel agents. And drugs with the right profile and the right value to patients, without taking consideration some of the market access and other issues that we heard about this morning, it's liable to be a very, large growing drug class. This is just one of many that are entering the B-cell malignancy space. So that said, so I just wanted to be brief, and I would like to hand it over first to Dr. Tom Kipps to give a update on the state of what's new in CLL and B-cell malignancies and what remaining needs there are to be addressed.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you on St. Patrick's Day about B-cell malignancies, but in particular chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I've been asked to try and give a background in terms of what we currently use and where we might be headed, but it is an exciting time with new developments of new therapies. I think one thing has to be borne in mind with cancers in general is that you know, when you look at the number of patients that are diagnosed, there can be great heterogeneity in terms of which patients might require therapy. And in CLL, it's even more daunting in that some patients after diagnosis can go many years before they develop symptomatic disease. So one has to use clinical judgment of when is the appropriate time to institute therapy. And clearly, if the disease is progressive or has disease-related symptoms, I think it's appropriate to begin therapy. But up until just a few years ago, it wasn't really determined that therapy actually prolongs survival. I think it's changed with the new therapies that we currently have. Another important consideration is that patients with CLL typically are older in their 6th, 7th, and 8th decade, and they can't tolerate the same therapy that kids may have. We had a nice discussion on CAR T cells, and part of the aspect is the tolerance of that therapy as well as the ability of cells to muster an immune response. So as we get older, of course, our tolerance for therapy, our ability to have certain forms of therapy will change. I think there have been certain prognostic features which you should know about. You can segregate patients, patients that might be more likely to require therapy early on, are ones that have mutations in their immunoglobulin genes in the leukemia cells. And so that's become a very useful surrogate marker. It's not absolute, but helps you to segregate out those patients that might require therapy within a few years of diagnosis. And there's some surrogate markers, too, such as this protein ZAP70. Now, where do we stand with the treatment? Now, we have these drugs now currently approved by the FDA. And what I have listed on the right side are four new agents that have been approved just since the last year and a half, and they're highlighted with arrows. We have the traditional chemotherapy, which has been the mainstay of treatment for many years, but now the advent of kinase inhibitors, such as Mike mentioned, and also monoclonal antibodies I want to touch on. And I would say the advent of the monoclonal antibodies has clearly improved survival of patients when it's combined with chemotherapy. So where do we stand with these therapies? Should we throw out chemotherapy now that we have these new therapies? Well, we have to take a hard look at how patients have fared with chemotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy. And this is being widely discussed among the CLL experts as to what patients might best benefit from chemotherapy. And so we have the ability to look back on studies that were conducted. The program at MD Anderson developed the regimen of combining chemotherapy regimens of fludarabine and cyclophosphamide with rituximab for the FCR regimen. And now we have long-term follow-up data where you can look at how those patients are doing. So this is 10 years follow-up, and you can see a subgroup where you have this plateau effect where patients may go on for many years after having received therapy. And so this needs to be borne in mind. Maybe patients can get into a complete remission and go on disease-free for many years and not require continuous therapy. I think that's something we need to bear in mind. The other aspect is that those patients that have the least aggressive clinical course may actually have a long-term benefit from chemotherapy. That's something that we also have to consider. The other thing, too, it's we do have genetic markers. We'll be hearing more about genetic markers from Omar. But these are the classic markers that are detected by fluorescence in situ hybridization. And you really can delineate subgroups of patients that might benefit from chemoimmunotherapy. But the most important one is the 17p-. That's typically associated with mutations or loss in P53. And I would say that if you have loss of P53, you're not going to respond to conventional chemotherapy. And actually, there's data to indicate that you can make the disease worse by impairing the marrow function and not eradicating the leukemia. So really, clearly, we have new strategies needed for 17p-, and that's really been the advent. Now, even though chemotherapy may be good for some patients, we have long-term follow-up data, and there are some late problems. So now we're trying to see, boy, this is a problem that's engendered by our success, namely long-term follow-up of patients treated with chemoimmunotherapy. One can see an increased risk for perhaps secondary cancers, Richter's transformation, or evolution to AML or myelodysplastic syndrome. So these are clear risks that you might have with chemoimmunotherapy. And many patients, even those patients that are in the good risk categories, are asking the question, well, should I take chemotherapy or not? And I think that has to be factored into the balance. We can't mandate patients to take a regimen, even though it might benefit them if they have strong concerns about some of these other late-term manifestations. It's going to be challenging. What about the biologics? Well, the CD20 antibodies really have been a game changer. First, rituximab, and the use of rituximab with chemotherapy, as I mentioned, has improved survival with therapy. That's clearly a benefit. We have some new kids on the block, ofatumumab and obinutuzumab. I don't know why they name these after African villages, but that's what it is. And the obinutuzumab, of course, one of my patients has called this rituximab with an attitude. It's been engineered to actually manifest increased ADCC activity. And I can tell you, we had one of the first patients treated in the United States, and she dropped her white count from 80,000 to 800 overnight. And she had a lot of symptoms with that, but and asked me whether taking additional therapy was going to kill her. I had to assure her that it wasn't. But clearly, this is a kind of glycoengineered antibody. And the German CLL study group has shown this. For example, on the left, you could see chlorambucil compared with chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. And the gold line is the progression-free survival chlorambucil, and the blue line is with the antibody. And that's compared head-to-head with patients who had chlorambucil and rituximab. And you could see that those patients that received obinutuzumab fared better than the patients that received rituximab. And based on this, the FDA approved obinutuzumab for frontline therapy of all patients. These were patients who were older and had medical comorbidities. And I must say, these types of head-to-head studies are going to be very important for biosimilars as well, because we have to try and get patients in randomized phase 3 trials to really know if there's a benefit for one antibody versus the next. So where do we stand with the new biology? Of course, there's been a lot of work on the biology. This disease has fascinated immunologists and biologists for many years. And what's very interesting, and that's true of B-cell malignancies in general, is that the B-cell is a very fastidious animal. We make 100 million B-cells every day, and most of them are grist for the mill. They die by the wayside. They're rearranging their genes to make an immune response. If they're not recruited to make an immune response, they're genetically programmed to eliminate themselves. And they have to have their friends help them in terms of getting the right response as well as surviving. And we know now a lot is emphasized with the microenvironment. And you have right square in the middle, the CLL cell, surrounded by a number of other cells which are found in lymph nodes and the spleen. And so this biology is very important to the leukemic cell, because if you take those cells out and put them in the laboratory, they don't grow and they actually die within hours. So they are very fastidious. Now, a lot of attention has been put on the antibody molecule, because the B-cell primary's job is to make antibodies, and this is a signaling component. Now, we noted that some years ago that those cells that were expressing the unmutated antibodies that expressed ZAP70 were more proficient at signaling, and that was potentially one reason why they were more aggressive, in that you can think about an antibody as being a receptor. And if the receptor is receiving a stronger signal, then those cells can go on to proliferate and grow faster and therefore be more aggressive clinically. Well, it's not lost on the pharmaceutical industry then to try and come up with ways to throw a monkey wrench into the signaling pathways. And these are the various enzymes that are involved in cell signaling. We observed that ZAP70 at kinase level was not really important. It was playing more of a scaffolding role. But these other enzymes, such as SYK and BTK, contributed to the growth and survival stimulus that you can get by cross-linking the Ig receptor. So now we have a plethora of different drugs, and I've highlighted these: inhibitors of SYK kinase, inhibitors of BTK, inhibitors of PI3 kinase, which is bound to some of these accessory molecules that help Ig signaling, as well as some other drugs. And I must say, these drugs have really been very helpful. They're targeting enzymes that are not encoded by mutated genes. Let me just say that again. They're not targeting mutations. We think of kinase inhibitors as targeting those tumors that have a mutation in that kinase. These are not mutated. This is just targeting those enzymes because the B cell has such a fastidious requirement for the machinery of B-cell signaling in order to survive. So what we're doing is we're playing a monkey wrench with the biology. I think it's a very important lesson we might be able to learn with other cancers as well. If we knew about the natural biology of tumor cells, we might be able to circumvent with small molecule inhibitors that actually take away some of the survival factors that cell requires, even though it may not be mutated. So we have to understand, too, that these enzymes are also involved in chemotaxis. So it's very important here, because if you block those enzymes, you're going to block chemotaxis and migration. And that's very important, because what happens here is we know that there's a dynamic recirculation, and this is true of a lot of B-cell malignancies, but in CLL in particular, it will go from the lymph nodes to the blood and back to the lymph nodes again. It's sort of like when you go home. You drive on the freeway, you get home, you get rested, you come back to work. Now, if you were to cut off and you couldn't get home, then you would be blocked out and you would be left to drive on the freeway until you'd crash from exhaustion. So these drugs actually inhibit chemotaxis. I think this is one of the primary mechanisms of action of these drugs because they block the ordinary recirculation that's required to get survival benefits. And so we have the drug ibrutinib, which is a poster child in that class. And I must say, I highlighted it inhibits CLL migration very well. And so it blocks it. So what patients, when they get treated with this, they have oftentimes a profound lymphocytosis, and the lymph nodes will shrink concomitantly. We had to change the guidelines for disease progression because patients oftentimes have a higher level of lymphocyte count after therapy than they had before therapy. And so this is something we have to take in mind. Now, it's clear that this drug has activity in CLL, and the trial comparing it with ofatumumab was published, we all know about, and it provided survival benefit over anti-CD20 antibody by itself. But it's important that the patients stay on the drug. There's not one patient I know of in the world who has achieved a complete remission without any evidence of leukemic cells on ibrutinib alone. Now, it's also not apparent with the antibodies. We have to find out, but patients are asked to stay on this drug, and that's something that's very important. We do have looking at the risk groups that might be benefiting, and I mentioned the 17P earlier. Well, those patients that lack P53 still respond to this regimen, so that's very important because now it's become an indication for therapy. So those patients who are 17P minus can actually have this drug as initial therapy. Now, we do see over time, though, even with the 17P minus patients, we see that they become resistant over time, even if they're taking the drug. And there have been some mechanisms for resistance, notably mutations in the very enzyme that is being targeted, BTK, which helps to show that BTK is indeed the target here. There's some other mutations identified in downstream signaling pathways. Now, I think it's important to bear in mind, you can ask the question, do we need other kinase inhibitors if BTK inhibitors work so well? Well, yes, I do believe we do. Idelalisib inhibits a different enzyme, PI3 kinase, and we've had some success in patients who have become resistant to ibrutinib to be treated with idelalisib. And idelalisib is currently approved for indolent lymphomas as well as for CLL in combination with rituximab. And that was based on this study here, which was published again last year, where that actually this is an interim analysis. So when we saw that the survival advantage was there for patients on idelalisib plus rituximab versus those patients who had received only placebo plus rituximab, we stopped the study halfway, and that allowed for registration of this drug for treatment of patients of CLL. So this is actually quite exciting that we have more tools. I do think that there's bandwidth for other kinase inhibitors. Because I say this, that there's no specific kinase inhibitor. A kinase inhibitor will be one that can inhibit that kinase and potentially other kinases. And there's going to be different spectrum in terms of overlapping toxicity that you might find with different kinase inhibitors. Now, can we combine these? Now, it has been tried. It was mentioned earlier that we should try to block all the pathways. And earlier today, we had some discussion of that, particularly like patients with BRAF inhibitors who ultimately relapse after having successful therapy. Well, this has been tried with two different kinase inhibitors, one inhibiting PI3 kinase, another inhibiting SYK. And what was happened in this trial is that out of 9 patients treated, 3 died of uncontrolled pneumonitis. So you can get very strange toxicity when you start playing games with these kinases in combination. If you start blocking them, we can get autoimmune conditions. And that has to be a word of caution, too, if we combine these agents with such drugs as the PD-1 antagonists or what have you. We might get into combinations with runaway autoimmunity that we have to deal with. So we do need other agents, but this is where we stand today. For initial therapy, it's recommended that patients consider chemoimmunotherapy. There's a variety of different ones. FCR is for the young, fit patient. Our bendamustine with obinutuzumab is now being considered as a good combination. We have also patients who are 17P minus. Those patients as frontline may be recommended to receive ibrutinib. For those patients who have relapse therapy, now there's more choices with ibrutinib versus idelalisib and rituximab, and also there's clinical trials too. And I want to mention that there's a very big excitement of some new agents, and I just want to mention a few in particular. One is a novel agent, ABT-199. Now, CLL is probably the poster child for a response with this drug. This is a specific inhibitor of a protein called BCL2, which blocks apoptosis. Now, CLL among cancers is one of the highest in expressing BCL2, and it expresses BCL2, but also expresses the executioner, namely an antagonist to BCL2 at very high levels. And when you offset the balance with an inhibitor to BCL2, then the executioner can take over and the CLL can collapse. It's like the novel tipping point where you get too much of a good thing. And this is one of the problems we've had with this drug, is that patients can undergo fulminant tumor lysis if they have ultimate large tumor burden. And so we have to be very careful about how we dose escalate. But that is just an indication of the activity. Now, with this drug, we've actually been able to achieve complete remissions, and we've actually carried patients into absence of any detectable disease, even in their bone marrow. And I really congratulate AbbVie, because I argued with AbbVie that I should be allowed to stop the drug, because I believe as a physician, you should be able to stop the therapy. Most patients do not want to take a drug every day. They want to stop the therapy and get cured and go on with their lives. Just think about how you would like to be treated. So we were able to do this, and now we're following up, and they've been off therapy longer than they've been on therapy and still doing extremely well in a complete remission. So I think this is very important to bear this in mind as we talk about how we integrate different types of therapies, talking about the problems of long-term success, the problems of late toxicity, the problems of having to take continuous therapy versus the issues of trying to get complete remissions. Very important concepts. There's a whole wealth of monoclonal antibodies that are being explored in this disease as well, including some of the immune checkpoint inhibitors. I just want to highlight one that is near to my heart because of we were doing a lot of work on it. This is ROR1, and ROR1 is an embryonic protein. It's expressed only in the early embryo, and then it attenuates at terms such that you don't find it in postpartum tissues, as we demonstrated down below, if you use very specific agents. It's a tyrosine kinase-like molecule. And what we noted was that ROR1, we found it because we were doing gene therapy trials in CLL where we made cellular vaccines and we gave them to patients. And we noted that some patients anecdotally did pretty well, and they made antibodies against their own leukemic cells that reacted with other leukemic cells. So we identified it as the leukemia antigen. And we identified the ROR1 as being a receptor for WNT5A that can stimulate non-canonical WNT signaling. And a subset of patients did extremely well. A subset of the patients that made antibody, which indicated not all anti-ROR1 antibodies were the same. So we developed transgenic model systems. We showed it can actually serve as an oncogene. It's present in leukemic cells of most patients with CLL. And we could see that when we generated nearly 100 different antibodies, we only found one that had the biologic activity. Some of the patients that we treated on the clinical trial, that was relatively low affinity, the D10, which served as a lead compound. And we were able to take that and then map the epitope and get higher affinity antibodies, humanize the antibody, fully humanize it, and bring it into animal models and do PK testing. And I'm sure all of you are aware of the filing for IND, which we were able to do last year. This is all done in the academic setting, so it was quite an education experience for us all. And we were able to develop the ROR1 antibody, which we called sirmtuximab, based on the granting agency of the CIRM had helped finance it. And now with the support of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we're able to take this into clinical trial. This antibody is exquisitely specific for leukemic cells, doesn't react with normal postpartum tissues, and we did a formal crosstalk binding survey with FDA-approved outsource agencies. And that's really remarkable about this. Now, the agency has not been done before. ROR1 has never been used in treatment, so we had to go very slowly, and we're going very low doses, and it's very exciting. We're starting at 50 micrograms per kilogram, but I'm very excited. This is being led by Kat Jamison and Michael Choi. That's the first infused bag, and we're actually seeing some very interesting clinical activity, even at the low dose that we have right now, so it's quite exciting. And I just want to leave with this, that the ROR1 protein we're finding is expressed on a variety of human cancers, and not just CLL. And so we're looking at how this might be used as a target for therapy against other tumors. And in particular, it seems to be expressed on the stem cell population of cancer. There's not much discussion here about stem cells, but cancer stem cells, I think, are real. There's a subset of tumors that might have the propensity to spread throughout the body as well as to reseed the entire tumor. And I think that what's been demonstrated is that the antibodies against this might actually allow for senescence of the stem cell population. So this is where we really, I think, should be headed in cancer biology, is that you have a tumor, and you may have seeds within the tumor, stem cells, that can repopulate the tumor. Now, conventional therapy looks at the mass of tumor cells, and we get happy because we're able to cut back on the amount of tumor that's present, but we may not be able to affect the seeds within the cancer. Whereas if we're able to get at the stem cells, understand more about the stem cell biology and eradicate them, then we may convert cancers into more like adenomas that don't spread and that don't recur after being excised are being treated. That would be my hope. And so if there are companies out there interested more in targeting stem cells, I'd be interested in talking with you about that. I certainly think this is a very exciting area to pursue. Anyway, happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks, Tom. Stan, you want to take it over?
No, great. Well, it's nice to at least get the slide since we missed the parade. while we're waiting for my deck to be loaded, you know, Tom has eloquently given you a landscape as to where things have gone and what clinical regimens and treatments we might think about. I'm going to focus on what those implications are as to how we think about bringing other agents that may not be on that list or even aren't thought about yet forward. And if we go back about 20 years ago, we had four crayons in the box. We had alkylating agents, we had corticosteroids, we had anthracyclines, and some places would still give vincristine. And we knew fludarabine and rituximab were coming. They were in the clinic, but they were not yet established regimens nor FDA-approved drugs. And it took about another 14 years for the crayon box to get bigger. And at that point, rituximab was there and used, but not yet labeled. That label came much later. Bendamustine came around that time, although it had been used in Europe for a long time. Campath was around as a later line agent, and fludarabine and rituximab as the combo were moving forward. And this is the crayon box today. So if you think about what's happened in 6 years, if you are at the bench and looking at a CLL or an NHL target for B-cell malignancy, your world has been turned upside down, and the standard tricks of how you're going to get a drug approved now have to be thought of differently. So there are three BTK inhibitors that are in clinical development. There are at least four PI3K, delta or gamma or some flavor thereof inhibitors. One very, very potent BCL2 antagonist, which Thomas talked about. And he showed you about 13 or 14 antibodies, but there will be more coming. Antibody conjugates were not tested, but there's at least two of those for B-cell malignancies that are in active clinical development. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the T-cell engagers. But in the mix, despite the challenges of bringing the CAR or TCR-type therapies into the B-cell malignancies, they're going to happen. And you saw the projections of what happens when you look at NHL versus ALL. So they're going to be part of the game, maybe not as the initial registration in CLL, but they are active. And indeed, as Dr. Brenchkin's pointed out, that was their initial play, was those three CLL patients changed the field. We aren't talking about IMiDs at all, but Revlimid is being used, particularly in combination with antibodies in a variety of clinical trials, and will likely continue to be an aggressively investigated non-chemotherapy-type regimen. Proteasome inhibitors are there. They're active in these types of diseases, although they're not labeled. CDK inhibitors have been tested now for a couple of decades and continue in clinical development. And then we have the what do we do with the checkpoint inhibitors, because they likely will make sense in some combination in the right patient in this group. So lots of crayons to pick out, lots of ways to color the picture, but no clear easy path forward for anyone who wants to get a drug approved in this space now. It is going to be extremely complex. So the regulatory space has changed dramatically with the list of approved compounds and big gaps until we got to the last couple of years. And this indeed was the cancer advance of the year, where you suddenly had two targeted therapies, two immunotherapies, but you've got more knocking on the door. So how are we going to move forward? I'm going to talk about one of the other alternatives now that isn't being talked about in the rest of the conference, and that's to use the T cells as the drug, but not by engineering the T cell, but by engineering a construct that gets the T cell to go to the target. And this was, again, another FDA-approved agent as of December 4 of 2014, Blincyto or blinatumomab was approved for relapsed refractory acute lymphoblastic leukemia. The construct is shown here. The idea is to take a tumor cell-specific antibody, fuse it with a linker to a CD3 recognition sequence in the green, and that drug is now blinatumomab when directed against CD19. We've already talked about what happens in the CAR space with CD19. I'm not going to belabor it. The challenge with this compound is its half-life. It's 2 hours, and when given by a discontinuous route of administration, a couple hours, a couple days a week, 1 week a month, it does not have activity, but it does have toxicity. It was only when it was administered for 4 to 8 weeks continuously for a cycle was activity demonstrated. So there are now seven studies that are enrolled in either ALL or NHL, and we'll talk about the key data from those, and 5 more that are going, but the challenge will be, where else do you go with B-cell malignancies given the space? So this is a photomicrograph or a confocal microscopy showing that the BiTE is actually forming the immunologic synapse between the T-cell and the tumor cell and allowing for the injection of perforins and granzymes to actually kill the cell in a serial manner. The BiTEs do evade many of the frequent mechanisms for immune escape, so it's just a proximity kill zone effect. It doesn't require the T-cell clone to be specific. It doesn't require class 1 or peptide presentation. It can recognize, take any T-cell, including those that would normally be considered T-reg cells, and license them to kill. But it does not evade all of the checkpoints, and there is emerging data, at least preclinically, and likely coming soon in the clinic, that the use of PD-1 or PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors with the bispecific T-cell engagers as a class will give you additional activity. So shown here is the clinical development program, but what's obvious is there is no CLL regimen in clinical trials despite very promising preclinical data because we don't know how we fit in the rest of the rainbow with this type of construct with a continuous IV infusion when you have a number of oral medications that are giving you 90 to 95% progression-free survival out at 1 to 2 years. So the data that convinced me that this was a real drug was actually not the lymphoma data. It was looking at a different population. And those are acute lymphoblastic leukemia patients who, while they were in complete remission based on blood count and bone marrow, had clear evidence of clonal leukemia by minimal residual disease assays. And these were initially done by PCR but could also be done by flow cytometry. And this was a group of patients that had exhausted the entire pharmacy chest that we had of 11 or 12 agents that we give through induction consolidation chemotherapy. And this drug had an 80% ability to take these patients and make them minimal residual disease negative, and nothing had ever done this. The T-cell was the drug. That T-cell is different, and this is entirely concurrent with what we see with the CAR T-cell therapies, that they are non-cross-resistant to the conventional chemotherapies that we've given for decades that made ALL a good disease if you were a kid, not so good disease if you were an adult, but now by harnessing the immune system, we have dramatically different results. And I'm spending a little bit of time on this to highlight that for a drug development and for CLL, this may be the way that we have to look to develop drugs, that we're going to have to look for an MRD negativity period, getting patients off continuous therapy. As Tom has mentioned, he's seen with venetoclax, but not so much with ibrutinib. And it may be those sequences or combinations that get patients to an MRD status that will be the next path for drug development in these diseases. So this was confirmed in a multi-center study where spot on the data were almost exactly the same as in phase 2, and that's very reassuring for what these T-cell engagers may do, roughly an 80% molecular response rate after one cycle of therapy. Now, these drugs do have toxicities, and they overlap very much with the toxicities that are seen with chimeric antigen receptor T-cells. The difference is with a 2-hour half-life, you can turn it off. You don't need a safety switch. There's no engineering. You stop administering the drug. You give steroids. You support the patients. But these types of adverse events can be quite threatening early in early development, but as additional clinical experience has been gained, they are easily managed. So the registration was based on a large multi-center phase 2 study looking at relapsed refractory patients, and one of the lessons here, and may be true for other immune active therapies, is come in with a low dose for the first week, allow the patient to get through their initial period of cytokine release, an equilibration, and after there's some tachyphylaxis, augment the dose. Again, a little bit different than what we do for many drugs where you pick a dose, you come in, and you stay there. For immune-based therapies, that's probably not such a good idea. And the data were pretty much spot on, a 43% CR-CRH rate in this heavily pretreated population. So what did we learn about these T-cell engagers? They're active at very low doses. These are microgram to doses, nanogram per ml. They work against proliferating and non-proliferating cells, so this, I would argue, is a stem cell agent, as Tom has laid out as something we should be interested in. It can work in different locations in the body, so we saw responses not only in the marrow and the blood, but in bulky node disease and an extranodal disease. Last line of therapy, it works. Works in old patients. The 78 or 87-year-olds have now been treated, as well as the kids, and I think Peter Adamson may have left the room. But we did something very unusual with the early development of this drug as a small company, and that is we got the European ALL group and the COG to let Micromet hold the IND and run an international phase 1, phase 2 study in parallel to the adult development. The activity is observed in severely immunocompromised patients, so you don't have to have a lot of circulating T cells to respond, and it offers a non-cross-resistant, non-chemotherapy alternative for the B-cell malignancies. So there is activity in lymphoma as well, but here's the challenge. How do you go against this crayon box that also applies to lymphoma when you have a continuous IV infusion? So I think the challenge here is this is the door opener of the T-cell engagers, and there are others that are coming, not only for CD19 or CD20, but for other targets. We'll see whether the extended half-lives of some of these constructs will sacrifice activity and whether this will offer another path to engage T-cells beyond the T-cell engineering approaches. Now, I want to talk about another compound that wasn't on Tom's list because it is an entirely different mechanism of action, but also because of the development path that Karyopharm has chosen, and that's the selinexor, which is a small molecule that blocks XPO1, which controls export from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. And the challenge here is this drug has shown activity in phase 1 in a variety of B lymphoid malignancies, and I've highlighted in yellow what I think are some of the more provocative data, but there's also activity in AML and myeloma that the company's pursuing. And so this is an active agent, but how, with all of the crayons in the box, do you bring it forward in registration? So the company has seen that there is some activity in double-hit lymphomas, which might be a particularly poor prognostic subgroup, and that, similar to suggesting pulling a poor prognostic population in CLL with 17P, may be a route to develop novel agents in a very crowded field. But the other really challenging population that Karyopharm has taken to explore in a potential registration strategy is the Richter's transformation patients. So these are patients who have CLL who then turn into a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And historically, this has been a very, very difficult population which to gain not only a response but to maintain survival. So the company has actually carved out that space as one where they are looking for early signal with a 50-patient trial. We'll see if it works, but I think it is emblematic of what pharma will need to do to try to develop additional drugs in this space is find a biologically different population, not the one that's 20,000 patients a year, the one that might be 2,000 patients a year, and go there as your initial registration and then look for the combination sequence and the biology. So here's how I see the development challenges stacking up. You're going to still want to have a monotherapy signal, but you are only likely going to be able to test that in patients who are extensively pretreated with all the crayons in the box. Combinations, either sequential or concurrent, represent the most likely clinical utility for most agents. There will be increased development cost, increased cost to the payers, and increased complexity. So approaches that incorporate minimal residual disease as a way of getting to a go decision and providing an early signal of clinical benefit are ones that will have to be tested aggressively in the coming years. Randomized studies will be increasingly costly. Think about a small company. They now need to compare against ibrutinib. And it's really unlikely that, whether it's AbbVie or Janssen, that they're just going to hand over the ibrutinib to their competitor in the space. So if you're now going to have to pay $100,000 a year for your comparator drug, how are you going to afford to do that clinical trial to get in those earlier lines of therapy? It's going to be a very daunting task, and this is one where the government and the cooperative groups are going to have to step in to figure out a path forward. So on the right is a crayon drawing, and I'm putting this here because we're going to have to think about disruptive ways. It's not going to be picking up the crayon, and one would like the gold or the silver crayon that you only get in the 96 or the 154 crayon box, not in the 4 or the 8 box, to draw with first. But you are going to have to take the crayons and melt them or use them in a different constructive way to come forward with therapies. So the route of administration, the duration of therapy, cost, and adverse event profile will contribute to the choices of the patient and the physician as they move forward, looking first at efficacy but also at safety. Targeted therapies and biologics will likely supplant nonspecific cytotoxic chemotherapy where affordable. And I want you to remember the slide Tom showed you looking at the FCR follow-up in 300 patients. That's a really good response. And is it really going to be worth $100,000 a year for that extra 20% increment? It goes back to how we started this morning, and I'd be interested in the audience's view as to how we're going to justify this as we look to try to find ways that actually cure patients. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Stan. So next up is Umar.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm going to follow up Tom and Stan now and talk about the genetics of particularly CLL amongst some other mature B-cell malignancies and what we learned about this disorder in relationship to some of the novel therapies we've been hearing about. So we'll focus predominantly on CLL, and the reason for this is a lot has been learned about this disease in the last few years, and a lot has been facilitated by the fact that there's quite ease of obtaining the tumor sample for genetic analysis in these patients. So there's been somewhere between 250 and 300 whole exomes or whole genomes of CLL patients published to date, and some of the basic lessons we've learned that I'll stress are the following. First, CLL is clearly marked by a very high degree of intertumoral heterogeneity, meaning genetic differences in the genes mutated and the frequencies of genes mutated between patients. And I think that reflects a lot of the clinical heterogeneity you heard about from Tom. The second is that in addition to the heterogeneity between patients, there's also intratumoral heterogeneity in CLL, which is very striking, and I'll show some examples, which is that nearly every CLL patient we know now has multiple subclones existing within them, and how they change as they're treated with therapy is going to be an important issue. And then lastly, ironically, the more we've learned about the somatic genetic alterations in CLL, and we've seen responses in new therapies, we've learned a lot that there's a central importance of the B-cell receptor itself, which, as Tom said, isn't mutated in the same way we see other genes being mutated in CLL, but it's clearly important in driving the disease. And then we'll talk about a little bit of resistance. So the photograph you see there, that's a picture from the paper by Dan Landau, Kathy Wu, and Gad Getz, published 2 years ago, looking at about results from whole exome sequencing from 160 CLL patients. And then on the right here is unpublished data recently from our group with targeted sequencing 500 genes of 200 untreated CLL patients. The thing to take away from this is if you look at the top mutated genes there, that you can't read a lot of the details, but the point here is that if you look at genes mutated in 10% or more of CLL patients, there's only maybe 3 or 4 genes mutated in 10% or more of patients. So the key here is that there are very few mutations that are actually shared among CLL patients. Almost everyone is different. There are many genes mutated only in one patient and very rarely reproduced amongst other patients. In addition to that, if you look at the genes that are actually mutated in these two lists compared to each other, you'll see there are a lot of differences, and each of these studies has at least 150 patients. So, for instance, the third most commonly mutated gene in our study, untreated CLL patients, was KRAS, and that's about 2 to 3% on the exome sequencing study on the left. And in addition to that, there are a number of MAP kinase pathway mutations notated in our study, not seen in the whole exome sequencing study. Similarly, other genes picked up in our study, not seen in others, are listed there. And the reasons for that we'll get into in a minute, but I think it has to speak to, there's so much clinical heterogeneity that the types of patients being sequenced in each of these studies is actually critical in what you find. The other critical point here is looking at the frequency of these mutations within patients. So this is a graph of the allelic frequency of the different mutations we saw in our study, looking at genes mutated in at least two patients. So if a gene is heterozygously mutated, it should be present in allelic frequency about 50%. And you see there are a class of genes that are mutated in that kind of category, but there's a whole set, including some of the most commonly mutated genes, which are quite subclonal. So to kind of illustrate that further, this is the allelic frequency of the SF3B1 and P53 mutations in our study. And you can see there's quite a few P53 mutations that are present in 1 or 2% of the CLL cells in a patient's body, which is quite subclonal. And they actually probably have importance, and I'll illustrate that in a minute. So the other concept here is that the majority of CLL patients have multiple subclones, which are genetically distinct, and understanding how these are affected by therapy and the response to therapy is going to be critical. And so this is a cartoon that I love from Kathy Wu from an editorial she wrote a few years ago illustrating this. So these are, you can see here in this illustration, multiple subclones in two different CLL patients. And as they're treated with therapy, we don't really have curative therapy currently, so everyone ultimately will relapse over time. Some patients will relapse such that the clones present pre-treatment are present in equal proportion post-treatment. In other cases, we'll see kind of this evolution where a subclone that was minor pre-treatment at relapse predominates the disease. And so here's an example of that. And Tom told you about the importance of P53 mutations in CLL and how it might even be detrimental to treat these people with chemotherapy. Here's a patient from our study in April 2008, was untreated but needed therapy because they developed anemia. And we did the genomic analysis, and the patient had four mutations you see listed there. And the three of the mutations were in all the cells, and there was a minor P53 mutant subclone, and 17P was otherwise intact at that time. The patient was treated with FCR chemotherapy, which was our standard of care really at that time, and what happened was the following, that P53 minor subclone actually expanded, and the allelic frequency you can see increased, and that's also because the patient actually, 17P, the wild type copy, became deleted in the entire CLL population. So you have expansion of 17P deleted P53 mutated clone in CLL. The patient was then further treated with a variety of therapies and basically continued to have persistent disease and developed two additional P53 mutant subclones in that background of 17P deletion. And this is what we see happening in a lot of our patients. We see this genetic evolution over time, which actually makes it harder to treat them. Another case with more of a non-modern therapy, another untreated patient, white count was in the 70s at presentation where they needed therapy. And this time the patient has an 11Q deletion and two separate ATM mutations. She was treated with a PI3K delta and rituximab. And you can see that she had some response. The white count went down from about 80 to 7. And the 11Q deleted subclone shrunk as well, but still were present. She was treated further, and we saw some further response, but still that ATM deletion and ATM mutation were present in this patient's body. So it's not curative, and we know that eventually this mutation would likely be the cause of relapse or other mutations acquired, as you can see, during therapy. So to summarize a little bit here, what we've learned is that the true frequency and spectrum of the mutations in CLL is not totally resolved, and there's going to be a lot of kind of combining publicly available data sets in the upcoming years to give us a broader sense of what's happening. The role of specific mutations in response and resistance is going to be critical, and we'll get into that in just the next slide. And then lastly, we showed a lot of mutations there, some of which are activating, such as some of the MAP kinase pathway alterations and some of these notch activating mutations, and they're present in CLL patients. Could they be the novel therapeutic targets in CLL? It's an open question. I think a lot of these mutations are clearly subclonal in CLL, and so there's a question of whether you actually want to target those or not. So this brings up the same kind of picture that Tom showed you, which is the B-cell receptor. So as we learn more about these mutations, as we've seen these responses to these novel BCR-targeted therapies, we've learned that the B-cell receptor itself is absolutely critical in this disease, and we've known that for some time. Now, in related diseases such as some types of diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, there are activating mutations in components of the B-cell receptor complex like CD79, A, and B. We don't see that in CLL, as Tom told you. But nonetheless, the B-cell receptor is absolutely critical, and there's something actually quite abnormal about the B-cell receptor in CLL. So we've learned, as we've begun to sequence the IGHV rearrangements in CLL patients for more than a decade now, we've known this, there is a skewed repertoire of the usage of the IGHV gene components in CLL. And this is Serco's plot there showing you the IGHB genes and IGHD genes that are rearranged in CLL. And there's this skewed usage of particular subsets of the IGHB in CLL patients. This is not random. There's something very specific about this usage. If you sequence the IGHB genes in more detail, you'll see that there's, in addition to that, very much highly stereotyped and quasi-identical antigen-binding receptors in IGHB in CLL patients. This is all kind of suggesting that something is quite abnormal and non-random about the B-cell receptor in CLL specifically. And basically, what we've learned is that the B-cell receptor itself is altered such that it has cell-autonomous kind of constitutive activity in CLL. So the basic idea is that normally in B-cells, you have an external antigen to signal through the B-cell receptor to stimulate a B-cell. But in CLL cells, that there's a cell-autonomous constitutive activation of the B-cell receptor. Very nice paper from Hassan Juma's group about 3 years ago identified that it's actually the B-cell receptor in CLL is actually recognizing an internal epitope which stimulates the B-cell receptor for this constitutive activity. The very last point here is about resistance. We heard a little bit about this from Tom. So we know ibrutinib binds to the cysteine 481 within BTK itself. And last year, 3 papers were published, a very nice series, 2 in CLL and 1 in mantle cell lymphoma, identifying mechanisms of resistance to ibrutinib. And we've learned that first, as Tom mentioned, that specific cysteine residue in BTK itself can be mutated such that BTK can no longer bind and inhibit, ibrutinib can no longer bind and inhibit BTK. We've also seen downstream of that, PLC gamma 2 can be mutated, activating PLC gamma 2 in a specific way. And one of these mutations, very interestingly, has actually been identified as a germline mutation in a familial inflammatory disorder. So the CLL cells are specifically selecting this to overcome resistance with ibrutinib. A lot of questions, and I'll probably stop with this in my mind seeing this data. First is, how frequently do BTK and PLC gamma 2 mutations actually account for ibrutinib resistance? So, for instance, in CLL, we've seen patients respond and then relapse with these mutations. But there are also patients that have kind of progressive disease despite being treated that develop resistance that don't seem to have BTK or PLC gamma 2 mutations. Something must else be going on in these patients. Likewise, in mantle cell, it was seen in the paper last year that those patients that didn't respond within the first 5 months of therapy within this study actually didn't have BTK or PLC gamma 2 mutations either. So something else is going on in those patients to account for resistance to ibrutinib. And I just want to point out again, we know about a lot of kinases downstream of these proteins in these B-cell malignancy patients. For instance, the MAP kinase pathway, CART11, MYC is altered. And all of these are potential, I think, things which could be driving resistance to these molecules. Other questions, we've seen, again, ibrutinib covalently binds to this cysteine 481. What about ATP-competitive inhibitors? Could they bypass this resistance mechanism? The PLC gamma activating mutations, do you actually need BTK in the face of those mutations? That's an important question. Drug combinations, I think, will be an important question also raised earlier. What about drugs used for ibrutinib-resistant CLL? We might hear about that more from Bill. Resistance to PI3K delta or BCL2 inhibitors. So far, nothing in the public sphere about that as far as I know. And these are all important questions, and I think actually I'll just go ahead and stop there. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Omar. So last up is Bill Grossman.
I'd like to thank Divine Health for the invitation to speak today. I'll wait for slides. These are my disclosures, employee of AbbVie, stockholder. Also wanted to discuss the fact that the two drugs, venetoclax and duvelisib, are partnered with Genentech, Roche, and Infinity, respectively. So I'll be touching just on a little bit of stuff that has already been covered by Tom, Stan, and Omar. As most of you already know, traditional therapeutics approaches to cancer has been chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation therapy. These are met with high toxicity, relatively continued poor long-term prognosis. And then with the current targeted therapeutic approaches, such as the RAS and ALK, these have improved patient outcomes, but in very small patient numbers, typically with lower overall toxicities as well. And so what we're trying to look at as a company is also the future potential for combining BCR and BCL2 targeted therapies in CLL. You can see that you can imagine different therapeutic combinations. I'll talk a little bit more on this later. But we believe that maybe this will improve patient outcomes for hopefully larger patient numbers and at least lower similar toxicities. However, that's obviously going to be a challenge as Tom had outlined before. So also I'm not going to belabor this point, but the goals of therapy for CLL have obviously evolved over time, evolving from palliation to progression-free survival and overall survival endpoints. However, surrogate markers for CR and MRD negativity are still not a typical goal for most physicians, and we probably will talk about that a little bit more later on. But you can see here that the different types of therapeutic combinations over time, again, are also very specific to the patient population, whether they're, you can see here, kind of the fit and, versus elderly and frontline versus relapse refractory. The other thing I want to point out in this slide is that, again, historically, these treatments have been short courses of therapy and are repeated upon progression. However, obviously, with newer agents, that's changed. And so these oral kinase inhibitors that have been talked about already have really transformed the treatment of CLL patients in and different population of subsets, and I won't go over the data. But despite these advances in CLL therapy, we do believe that there continues to be patient subsets with high unmet clinical needs, as been discussed by Tom and others, including unmutated patients that are less susceptible to FCR, to traditional chemoimmunotherapy, as well as the P17 or deletion and P53 mutation patients. This is a very similar slide as the others. I swear we didn't plan on this, but you can see that with the targeting of B-cell malignancies, there's a traditional anti-CD20 antibodies, and then we have all these newer and emerging therapeutics that are obviously hitting downstream molecules from both BCR signaling as well as the chemokine receptors, as mentioned before. With the venetoclax, we're at the very bottom of the stream of signaling, again targeting the anti-apoptotic cascade. So obviously there's a clear rationale then for combining some of these novel therapeutic agents by these interconnected BCR and apoptotic pathway signaling events. Some of the potential rationale for the different targeted therapeutic combinations include, it's been documented at least in some of the ex vivo data, a potential escape mechanism of PI3 kinase inhibitors in CLL through an increase in BCL2 expression, which obviously would be neutralized by BCL2 inhibitors. PI3 kinase and BTK inhibition, as Tom mentioned, blocks the homing of malignant B cells, both in the lymph nodes as well as in the bone marrow, exposing them to more sensitive agents in the periphery, such as anti-CD20 and BCL2 therapies. And then finally, PI3 kinase inhibitors have been shown to liberate BAD component that antagonizes BCL2 and BCL-XL and results in B cell sensitization to BCL2 inhibitors. So this is my only data slide. Again, just kind of showing some of the independent trial results to make you aware that these are not comparison studies, and so this is obviously have to be taken with those issues at hand. But what I want to point out is that with the monotherapy of the newer agents such as ibrutinib, idelalisib, and venetoclax, you can see that the overall response rates are very, very good compared to historical chemoimmunotherapy. The other thing I wanted to point out is what's in gold there, which is the complete response rate. So although there's different mechanisms of actions, obviously, for ibrutinib and idelalisib compared to venetoclax, you can see that with monotherapy, venetoclax and venetoclax with Rituxan, you can see emerging CR rates or complete response rates. So historically, at least, again, independent trial results, you can see bendamustine and Rituxan achieving a CR rate of 9% versus FCR of 24%. Ibrutinib, again, different mechanisms of action, so we're not expecting CRs, but you can see when you add in Rituxan, you have an increase in CR rates. And then finally, with venetoclax as monotherapy, we are achieving roughly 20%+ CR rates, and then the addition of Rituxan appears to increase that as well. And then when we start looking at the MRD rate, or minimal residual disease rates, again, trying to look at the 10 to the minus 4th as a cutoff line, you can see that there are significant differences in these combination therapies as well. You can see, again, based on the different mechanisms of actions, it's hard to compare ibrutinib with idelalisib and the other agents. But when you look at venetoclax or venetoclax plus Rituxan, you're achieving MRD rates that are appear to be at least initially lower than or higher than that is achieved by the traditional chemoimmunotherapy. So what we have now is kind of three different evolving CLL treatment paradigms. At least this is the way I think about them. Historically, there's been always a short treatment of chemoimmunotherapy with a long, hopefully a long observation period in these patients. Again, undoubtedly, most of these patients relapse over time if given enough time. And this has been a historical approach. With the newer agents, such as ibrutinib and idelalisib, the paradigm shift has changed to treatment to treat to progression. Again, we're seeing substantial long-term clinical benefit in these drugs, but there are clearly patients that will relapse and appear to be relapsing quite quickly and aggressively upon some of the mutation acquisitions, as mentioned by Omar. And so this is also a question of we've talked about earlier on this morning, which is potential long-term financial toxicity with these treat-to-progression therapies that are now the, kind of the emerging as a new treatment paradigm in CLL. So what we're proposing to do, and we've started many studies on this already, is to try to combine these novel agents, whether already marketed or emerging, based on the rationale that I discussed before around the signaling pathways. What we've seen so far, as I mentioned in the prior slide, is that we're seeing to get higher depth of responses, including CR as well as MRD negativity. And we're the big question here is whether or not we can actually then take these patients off therapy. As Tom mentioned, he's already had some patients, as well as other investigators, that have come off drug therapy such as venetoclax after achieving a CR MRD negativity, and they've been on drug for long, or they've been off drug longer than they've been on drug. So we're curious to know if this is actually something that can be achieved in the future. And the question is then, when you start talking about these combinations, can we reduce the combination financial toxicity? So I just added another adjective there to describe it. But with shorter courses of therapies, it's potentially that maybe we can prevent this from happening, especially when we monitor patients for these surrogate markers of deeper responses, such as CR and MRD negativity. So there's obviously a lot of needs for success for personalized medicine that's been discussed before. The one I want to kind of talk about and focus on is the partnerships and collaborations. We, among others here in the room, have started to do this aggressively in the oncology space to try to be competitive. And I won't go over all of these things, but everyone that knows this is part of collaboration and partnership knows that there's pros and cons. And some of the pros include obviously minimizing internal risk, R&D time, risk, and expense to develop multiple assets, leveraging the footprint from a commercialization perspective to minimize costs, avoidance of IP infringement or potential collaboration around IP that each company has. And there's lots of cons, and again, you can come up with a lot longer list than this here, going from governance decision-making to different prioritization between the companies, especially with different commercialization interests against their portfolios. There's the regulatory issues around approval. And, of course, with any contract, demonstrating reasonable effort as well as roles and responsibilities. So despite these issues and hurdles, as have been mentioned before, you can see that there's been a ton of, left out a lot of different companies here, but these are just some recent examples of the different partnerships and collaborations that are occurring. And it's not just between two companies, it's between multiple companies now to really kind of leverage their portfolio and assets to look at the ability to combine these different agents together. However, with these partnerships and collaboration also comes a lot of payer and market uncertainty and trying to achieve this personalized medicine. So you can see that historically, obviously, with payers in particular, having a single agent, single indication, and one partner is a lot easier. But now we're into the combination therapies with multiple indications, multiple partners, and different interests. And this will only lead to continued market uncertainty. In addition, which has been mentioned here as well, is that in particular these novel therapies, when they're combined, obviously, again, have this financial toxicity. So it's going to be, again, trying to approach it to different ways I mentioned before of trying to avoid this long-term financial toxicity that we are on the verge of here as well. So that was that one. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Okay. So, all right. So we presented a lot of information. Any questions out there before we get into the few questions for the panel? No? Question over here? No? Okay. So, so you presented a lot of impressive data on the novel agents, between ibrutinib, adalimumab, and venetoclax and Gazyva. So is the problem solved? You know, given the fact that CLL, was the median incidence is 72 or something like that, and it looks like there might be durable responses, with this new treatment paradigm. Is the problem solved? What are the unmet needs beyond what was presented here? How well is it being translated into standard clinical practice?
Sure. I think the cancer fighting cancer is sort of like whack-a-mole. Seems like every time you get success one way, there's something that comes up. It's always something. I do think that tolerance to these therapies. Some of the patients who participate on clinical trials are sort of like that knight in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where he gets his arm cut off and he says only a flesh wound. These patients are desperate to stay on therapy. They're getting the trial drug, and they don't want us to actually get off the trial. So they are willing to incur grade 1, grade 2 toxicities because they're usually pretty well educated, and they know the score in terms of if they stop therapy, they may have a deleterious event. I think it's different, though, when you approach a patient who's not so informed. The doctor says, well, you have this leukemia, take this pill, take 3 pills every morning, and the patient takes the pills and has some mild side effects such as diarrhea or arthralgias or fatigue or any of a number of things that can happen, grade 1, grade 2 toxicities. They come back complaining to the doctor and say, well, I've had this drug now for a few months. When do I stop? And it's harder to understand if that's going to be licensed by some patients. I think that's a real problem. I do think that there's also the cost issues, and although I know that there are plans to mitigate the cost, it's still formidable if there's copay. So that produces a financial aversion to long-term therapy. And if you combine all that, you have patients who may skip a dose or two because they may want to do so just to feel better or because it's less expensive. I know that with Gleevec, which is the poster child for this, in the treatment of CML, the leading cause of resistance to Gleevec is patient noncompliance. And about 67% of patients, it's estimated, on Gleevec miss a dose or more. And many times they miss several doses and take it 2 weeks before they have their doctor's appointment. How do they know this? Well, they've given patients bottles that have a registry so that they know exactly when the bottle was opened. And they collect the bottles and they find out that patients may go many days without having opened that bottle. And then they start opening the bottle up repeatedly during the time before the medical visit. I can't think of a better way to try and induce drug resistance than that. So part of the job will be patient education. We have to also wait and see whether new combinations will be able to allow patients to achieve a result, which I think we all desire in terms of getting into a remission that's long-lasting without having to take additional therapy. How that's going to play out in the older population, I don't know. So we have a lot more tools right now. I think it's a lot more promising than it was before. I don't think we can say we're done. And I think the excitement was going to be in trying to define truly effective therapy that has minimal side effects and is able to essentially potentially cure some patients with this disease. So
to address, those unmet needs, right now the novel drug combination trials are ongoing and, we'll be learning more about that. What about of the novel agents that we talked about, that haven't been approved yet or, things that may not be next in class? Is there anything that's going to address these patient needs that you see in the horizon beyond, things that we're more familiar with?
Well, I think that's the hope of some of the next generation in-class agent. So as Tom has mentioned, compliance and interest and ability to stay on an agent chronically will be important. So if you can come up with something that's got a slightly better side effect profile, it may have some ability to penetrate the market, help more patients, and give better results. So I think that that's what we're seeing now with the additional PI3K inhibitors that are still in development and the additional BTK work. And, to my mind, none of them get to the issue Omar raised, nor do they get to the data on the 17 Ps that Tom showed. So there's still this opportunity that you will have a subgroup that will not have a durable response. The patient either can't comply with the regimen or the regimen won't work based on the biology. So those become the areas to focus on. What can you do that's cheap, easy, highly effective with the hope that it's going to be curative? And so getting the course of therapy down, as Bill has mentioned, to a shorter duration with those sequences, likely involving some of the immunologic responses that we're now starting to harness, I think will be the additional road to cure. But, compared to where we were 20 years ago, it's just like melanoma. Melanoma nobody wanted to see before. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, bring it on. CLL, we kind of liked it because the patients didn't die that fast, but they were older. We had a limited set of options for them. Now your brain explodes in trying to decide what you give and what sequence to what patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the concept of the sequence. And we heard from Tom about the ibrutinib-resistant patient that was then treated with adalimumab. We had someone that was ibrutinib-acquired resistance that responded very well to BCL-2 inhibition. I think it's very early days of trying to understand the sequence in order to give some of these novel agents. If you don't respond to one, how would you respond to the other and so forth? So, there's a lot, mostly for these high-risk patients, of course, to figure out still with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd reiterate what was said, that it would be interesting if we can't combine these novel agents to really understand what is the sequencing, the appropriate sequencing, and looking at the genomics, omics, to help inform us on that sequencing.
Well, I will say a point about that, if I could just be a little controversial. We did have a nice discussion this morning about breast cancer and finding the mutations that you can target. I think this is the opposite. We're not really targeting mutations. We're going after the biology. And I must say, homage this morning was paid to Virchow, who was this great pathologist in Germany who was able to see cancer under a microscope and identify cancer. He didn't have any omics to do that. And there are certain hallmarks of cancer that have been identified. Weinberg has published on this, too. We know what cancer is, and there's two lines of thought in terms of trying to understand its biology and trying to circumvent those aspects of cancer which count for the disease that we know in patients who have cancer. And I think this is more along that line of approach, where you have understanding about the biology, and you're playing on the weaknesses of the cancer. And this is independent of knowledge about whether they have NOTCH1 mutations or FS3B1 mutations or what have you. I will say, with one exception, though, of course, the P53 mutations and potentially the ATM mutations, which is clear that our previous therapy of chemotherapy was a therapy that was ineffective and possibly made patients worse. Now, with the advent of these newer drugs, which do not operate through a P53-dependent mechanism, that again is being thrown out. So we are not even having to worry about that. I know that I just got back from Australia. They're wondering whether they should even do FISH analysis now before rendering these new therapies. So this is the missing omics. And it would be nice. I've heard it said that breast cancer is 1,000 different diseases. My God, if breast cancer is 1,000 different diseases, good luck to us all. And I've heard it also said that you can actually try to target different combinations. It will be very complicated, and I can imagine that if it's very effective, then of course. But obviously, if we can obtain methods that are simpler and more tailored to the disease and helpful to many patients, that would, I think, be desirable.
Hmm. So at least in the CLL community, was there a question over here? Good.
Data which was very interesting. Thank you. It was sort of an anomaly between the endpoints, and more generally, I'd like to raise the issue of MRD because I'd like to know what the panel thinks about using MRD, which has not yet been clinically validated to correlate with survival. But would you think it will? But but that's my question was actually about one of your data slides showed something like 20% response rate with venetoclax, and then with, when you added in rituximab, went up to about 30% or something like 15 to 20. But then if you looked at MRD, and this is why I wanted to bring up the issue of MRD, you had 8% response with venetoclax, and then you added in rituximab, and you had a 35% response, more than a fourfold increase in MRD when you did the combination, depending on the endpoint, right? So if you looked at MRD, you see this huge increase, but if you look at response rate, you do not. And I'm curious whether you want to comment on that, and then more generally ask the panel what they think about MRD as a future of CLL.
Sure. The numbers that you're quoting there actually were the CR rates, so the actually overall response rates were much higher than that, so in the order of 70 to 80%. So that's the overall response rate. The CR rates are I believe what you're recalling there. And then the CR, and what's still intriguing to us actually is the MRD negative individuals. It's primarily in the CR patients, but we do have PR patients that are also MRD negative. These are patients that have very, very small, just slightly over 1.5 lymph nodes. So they haven't achieved that from a CR perspective, but are achieving both peripheral and bone marrow MRD negativity. And so I think largely the data set that has been generated by CLL 8 and 10, again, show that there is a very good correlation with MRD negativity and long-term clinical benefit. And so we haven't made that correlation yet, but that is where I think the data is definitely going, including MD Anderson, among others. But I'd also be interested in hearing the clinicians on the panel because this is obviously not something that the typical physician, like I mentioned, even does. I mean, a lot of the community docs don't even do bone marrow assessments in these patients. And so the question is, what will the value of the surrogate marker be, assuming that we can get it through from a regulatory perspective?
Well, last year I participated on an FDA panel to assess the MRD and relevance, and we came to actually went through all of the data, and MRD, becoming MRD negative is quite significant in terms of prolonged disease-free survival after therapy. And it's evolving. We use flow cytometry at levels 1 in 10,000, but there's new genomic techniques that can detect 1 in a million, which I think will become the gold standard. So we'll be able to detect 1 in a million cells. And I believe if you get down below that level, you should be able to stop therapy and have a long-term disease-free remission. I think that's clear. The FDA didn't come out to publish one way or the other because they were evaluating ibrutinib and idelalisib at the time. And it's complicated because nobody gets to be MRD negative with ibrutinib. And that's true with also the combination. It's also true of idelalisib. All these kinase inhibitors do not clear MRD. So the patients are advised to stay on the drug. And that's, I think, a very important concept, though, if we can get down to MRD. Because if we're going to cure this disease, I think we're going to have to achieve MRD negativity.
Okay, I think we're running over a bit. As you see, it's a very complex space. I think we're still just kind of skimming the surface of B cell malignancies, and spent much of the time on CLL. But I want to thank the panel for discussion. If everybody's around for cocktails and sushi at 6:30, we can discuss MRD a little bit further. So,
thank you.